Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And welcome back, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Pleasure to be here.
Lionel, you were in full spate there just before we started recording. You got a few things to get off your chest this week, I think. That week off has built up a real head of steam, haven't you?
Possibly, yeah. I may edit my thoughts slightly for the podcast for public consumption, but a couple of things came up out of the World Championships.
Judging by what you were saying, I think that'd be very wise, unless you want this to be our final podcast.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis, we've got the big talking points covered.
So we're meeting just after the World Road Race Championships have just finished in Ponferrada. So we're going to reflect a little bit on the weekend's road race in particular. We talked in last week's podcast about Bradley Wiggins' victory in the time trial. And we're going to talk about, in particular, the men's road race on Sunday, the women's road race on Saturday as well. So shall we start with the men's road race, won by Mihail Kwiatkowski, friend of the podcast. Possibly.
Oh, come on, we're throwing these titles around willy nilly now. I mean, right. It's too easy now to become friends. You know, these should be like Blue Peter badges. They should be very, very difficult to.
When I say friend of the podcast, I mean we interviewed him once.
Yeah, exactly.
And spoke about him a bit. We did interview him after stage 13 of the Tour de France. You'll find that in our Tour de France podcast, the stage 13 one. We spoke a little bit then about Kwiatkowski, and we had an interview with him where he spoke a bit about his form, how he lost confidence before the Tour at the Dauphiné. He had a fantastic start to the year, rode incredibly well. Strade Bianchi won that race ahead of Peter Sagan. Daniel?
Yeah, that was when he was going like a dog, wasn't it? I said in the last podcast that Kwiatkowski was going like a dog, but he was more like a kind of beagle or something like that, or I'm not big on dogs, but yesterday was more, you know, greyhound, husky. He was very impressive, wasn't he?
Well, can I say, let's talk about the race, because it perhaps wasn't a thrilling spectacle. It had a certain tension and drama to it, I suppose, if you like watching riders riding round and round and round a circuit. We were comparing it to Milan San Remo, and the difference in Milan San Remo, obviously a long race as well, but there's a sense of a journey, obviously, and you know, a beautiful landscape. In Ponferrada, it perhaps wasn't quite as picturesque, but it's impossible not to greatly admire Kwiatkowski's win, the manner of victory. He attacked on the descent before the final climb. It was a very audacious move, very brave move, and I think a very worthy world champion. And great to see such a talented young rider, just 24, when, you know, he'll be wearing the rainbow jersey next year.
Yeah, it was a great win, thoroughly deserved, cleverly thought out, because the obvious thing to do would be to attack on that final climb. But he knew that he needed more of a gap going over the top to give him something to defend on the descent. And basically, he judged it absolutely perfectly. But let's not overlook the fact that the race as an entertaining spectacle was a complete turkey. And I say that as somebody, I watch the World Championships every year, I love that kind of ratcheting up of tension, but there really wasn't any. I mean, the last lap was just about enough to make me not regret sitting watching 4 or 5 hours of it. But
does a finale look like that not, it's like the ends justifying the means, does that not sort of override what has gone before and almost validate it somehow? It was a race that where it was always going to be about the final lap, and it was a superb final lap.
Rich, you drew the parallel with Milan San Remo. It was very like Milan San Remo, and the only difference was the finish line was sort of 3 kilometres closer to the top of the final climb. It's the film that you've seen hundreds of times before, you know the ending, yet it's still somehow compelling. And I thought that was the case with the World Road Race yesterday. We all knew how it was going to end. You know, people talked about the 5-minute World Championship, the 10-minute World Championship. That's what it was. And the interesting thing, you know, about Kwiatkowski's attack line, you said it was well thought out. He's admitted in the press conference it was totally instinctive. I think he planned to go on the final climb, and I think that was why he was able to get away, because everyone had become so focused, everyone was convinced that was the only thing that was going to break the deadlock, the big attack 200 metres 300 metres from the top of the final climb. which made it the perfect move, didn't it? Because that was pretty much the finish line, the top of the climb. I mean, there was anyone who had 7 seconds, even 6 seconds going over there was always going to be very, very difficult to catch. And it was interesting that Simon Gerrans said he didn't even see Kwiatkowski go, which just shows you the extent to which everyone was completely focused on, you know, the final half of the last climb, really.
So really, yeah, it was my fault for watching 5 hours of it.
Yeah, absolutely your fault. I certainly didn't watch 5 hours of it. I was out mountain biking and caught the exciting stuff. But no, I think had it been thought out, it would have been well thought out, because as soon as he had that advantage, I mean, he sort of leapfrogged up to the four man group that was up the road, and you know, a reasonably strong group. Demarchi was there, Cyril Gauthier was there, but they weren't committed at all. It was a very sort of tentative attack by those four. He leapfrogged up to them, sat there for a moment or two to get his breath back, and then went again. And as soon as he had that, it was only an 8-9 second gap behind. Everybody was looking at everybody else, and the only sort of concerted chase was Philippe Gilbert on behalf of Greg Van Avermaet. We talk a lot at the World Championships about the conflict between trade team alliance and national alliance. That was a perfect scenario for those two, because of course, as well as being Belgian teammates, they are trade teammates. I was also thinking Gilbert would probably have been quite happy to chase down a quick step rider, being a Belgian who's never been part of that sort of almost pseudo Belgian national team. So there are all these sorts of things going on as well. But behind, you're always thinking that if you do fully commit, especially on a course like that, that you're just going to be working for somebody else. Somebody else is going to benefit from it. So, and there were so many big hitters still there that also counted in Kwiatkowski's favour, I think.
Yeah, the fact that, for instance, Tony Gallopin was in the group behind the Gilbert group, and he refused to work on the pretext that they had Buhani behind. But, you know, with hindsight, we all talked about this kind of, it was almost a big cross marking the spot where you needed to go on the final climb. But with hindsight, Kwiatkowski went in the perfect place, because the way the climbs, the way the course was set up, it was climb, descent, and straight onto the last climb. And you know, your momentum almost took you halfway up the final climb, didn't it? So anyone who took that climb, you know, with a 3 or 4 second advantage, it was always going to be quite difficult to reel in, and that proved to be the case. But there were a number of sprinters, like you say, Richard Christoph, Buhani, or fast riders anyway, who just really needed, it was key to have 2-3 guys towards the end of that final climb who could really, you know, do some big pulls and bring you back to whoever had gone away. But they didn't have that. We'd seen that in pretty much all the races, especially the under 23 race. The Aussies had looked as though everything was completely under control, they controlled everything, and then they just fell apart in the final lap. And that's really happened yesterday. The race just imploded.
That the course, as boring as it might have been, did make the race interesting from a tactical point of view. It was almost a Geelong 2010 where Tor Hushovd won, and it was a big bunch sprint. Had it been a bunch sprint in Ponferrada, there was a sort of shadow world championship with the sprinters in the third group on the road, if you count Kwiatkowski. Then there was the group of chasers, and then they were led across the line by Christoph, Degenkolb and Buhani. So that conceivably could have been the top three had it been a big group sprint. But yeah, I mean, that did make it fascinating tactically. And you know, Simon Gerrans, who we tipped to ride well, did ride well and was second. But it was had it been the big group sprint, he wouldn't have won the sprint. Had it been it needed to be the size of group that he was in, but obviously without Kwiatkowski off the front. And yeah, he was he's a very proud patriot, I think, very proud Polishman. It was a strong team performance from Poland. You laughed there, Daniel.
Polishman.
Is that right? Polishman. A pole. Yes. Sorry, a pole. Sorry, I was distracted there. A Pole. He's a very proud Pole, and it was a very strong Polish team performance. They obviously qualified a full team with thanks to Rafał Majka and Kwiatkowski himself, and they rode very well. They really took an awful lot of responsibility early in the race, as Lionel will know if he was sitting on his couch watching it.
Well, look, I'm enjoying the fact that, you know, you're making a sterling case for it being an interesting, fascinating last lap. But I don't think the comparison with Milan-San Remo stacks up. In Milan-San Remo, you know that from the Cipressa onwards, things are going to start happening, and that there will be something going on all of those climbs leading up to the Poggio. yesterday, really nothing happened until the last lap. And I, you know, yes, Philippe Bouvet and L'Equipe and Daniel, I think you said it, the 5-minute world championships or the 10-minute world championships. But I think the showcase race of the year, the kind of the crowning one day event of the season, needs to have more to it than just a compelling last 5 minutes. The rest of it was turgid.
Does it ever though, Lionel? I mean, that is the beauty of the, you think so? I mean, I think Rich made the comparison with them. Which worlds did you say, Rich?
Geelong.
And I think it was very similar to Valkenburg as well. You know, that was pretty much a 10-minute world championship. We always knew that it was going to come to the Kooyberg and the 2 kilometres after the Kooyberg. It was very, very similar yesterday.
Yeah, but things happened prior to that. Groups went away.
There was stuff yesterday, no?
Tony Martin on his own, you know.
Nibali fell off. Chris Froome abandoned.
Yeah, and you know, the Italians tried with De Marchi and Visconti. They knew they didn't have many other options. Gautier went away to try and take the pressure off the French. So there were, ultimately ended up not being very significant, those sort of minor kind of episodes, but there were things happening. It was all very subtle, but you know, stuff was going on.
There's also, is there not, we were talking about this a little bit earlier before the podcast, there are certain riders who race well on circuits. You know, Matty Breschel was fourth, having been all but invisible for quite a long time, but he often pulls out a good ride at a world championship. And there's certain riders who do seem to be good at riding in circles. Tom Boonen also was riding very well at this year's Worlds for the first time in a few years.
Yeah, I was speaking to Dmitry Konyshev, who was the only Soviet rider, Soviet at the time, to ever get a medal in the World Championships, about this recently, and he said that it suited him perfectly because it meant mentally you could almost switch off. He always struggled with things like the Tour of Flanders, not knowing when the decisive action was going to come, and it's almost as though with some riders they already have a clear film of what's going to happen where in the race, you know, for the first few hours, first 200 kilometres, and they can almost relax. Whereas, you know, that's obviously not the case in something like the Tour of Flanders. So I think, yeah, there are some riders who mentally enjoy that.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freen.
Okay, so we're still talking about the World Championships in Ponferrada, and Saturday was the women's road race won by Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, the young French rider. Bit of a surprise to some people, but not really when you look at what she's done and what she's capable of. She's only 23 years old, a great talent, a great all-rounder, very versatile. But it was as much, the headlines were as much about Marianne Vos and the Dutch woman. First time she's finished out of the medals since, I believe, 2006, which is extraordinary, really. That is, for, you know, road races are such lotteries to have that type of consistency. It's similar to Fabian Cancellara in the so-called Monument Classic.
Valverde, indeed, in the Worlds.
Valverde in the Worlds. What was that? His sixth medal. Sixth medal, still without a win. But yeah, so Vos perhaps wasn't the force of old. I don't think it's the end of the Vos era. No, so long, Marianne. But Lionel, what did you make of the women's race?
Well, it was an...
Are you going to be equally damning of that?
It wasn't a great watch either. It really wasn't a great watch. There was a long time in which really nothing was happening. Alison Powers of the USA went on the attack to try and provoke something, maybe get a little move going. But I mean, I think really she was working, taking the pressure off Shelley Olds, who was a US sprinter in that group. And then Rachel Nalin of the Aussie team did the same thing. And then really it sort of exploded into life the last time up the climb. There was quite a bit of aggression on the climb the final time. And then Lizzie Armitstead, the British rider, she really sort of powered over the top, and only three riders could go with her. Marianne Vos, of course, was strong enough to stay with her, but also Eliza Longo Borghini of Italy and Emma Johansson, and that looked to be it. They had a gap that looked like it was going to be enough for them to contest the medals, and I think the fact there were four of them was probably the start of the problems that they had on the run in, because I think if there'd been three riders and everyone had been guaranteed a medal, they may well have cooperated a little bit more together. But because somebody was going to lose out completely, there was such a lack of incentive to put in the work to keep the group away. And Emma Johansson tried to jump them a bit just as the descent flattened out. Then Armitstead and Vos are then naturally going to be watching each other. I mean, they've raced each other They remember the London Olympics, the running up to the Mall in 2012, you know, where it came down to a pretty close sprint, and it looked like that might happen again. I think they would have had the beating of Longo Borghini in the sprint. Johansson, you know, she perhaps needed to make some kind of move, and they got caught basically with too far to go to open the sprint up, and you know, they were looking around at the group being powered up to them by the Germans, and they took it. I mean, it's easy to say the inexplicable decision to sit up and wait for that group when there was 700 metres to go, because they did have the race more or less to decide amongst themselves, and no one would open up the sprint and no one would go for a flyer. But from a tactical point of view, whoever moved first would probably have missed out altogether. So it was an incredible, almost jaw-dropping moment in the race. And then the group kind of all came back together, and then it was a fairly chaotic sprint, and Pauline Ferrand-Prévot won the sprint. And I mean, you say a surprise, she's obviously talented. I saw her win at Flèche Wallonne earlier in the year in April, you know, when she won on top of the Mur de Huy. So she's a phenomenal talent. And as for Marianne Vos, you know, if she'd been at her absolute best, then maybe she would have taken it up, maybe she would have been able to put a bit more in to the final kilometre and a half or so. But she'd not had a great week. It's been a long season, perhaps wasn't arriving at the World Championships in her best form. Got dropped in the team time trial last Sunday, so clearly wasn't on her A game, and had she been, maybe the finish would have been different.
It's funny, I should say, by the way, Ferrand-Prévot, I accused her of being 23 earlier, she's actually still only 22. She's the national road race champion, time trial champion, cyclocross champion in France, as well as winner this year at Flèche Wallonne, so very versatile.
And mountain bike relay.
World champion, no, mountain bike relay.
Apparently.
Yeah, don't forget that. It's funny though, knowing that Marianne Vos was not at her best, you would have thought that would have opened the race up a bit more and encouraged some others to have a go. We should mention also the slight controversy over the again, it's something I mentioned earlier about this the trade team, national team allegiances that can sometimes disfigure the World Championships a little bit. And there they are professional teammates, Vos and Ferrand-Prévot, Rabo-Liv, the Dutch team. I don't know, there was a claim afterwards that Vos had said that they were working for her in the event of it being a bunch sprint. I don't know how seriously that should really be taken. Lionel's shaking his head.
No, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, you know, there aren't a huge number of women's trade teams, you know, you can see where the alliances may lie fairly easily, but I don't know. I mean, would Marianne Vos basically sit up in a group of four?
Not if she was going as well as she can go. I think that's the key, the crucial thing, isn't it?
But you say, would people have attacked more if they'd known Marianne Vos was under par? But perhaps they didn't, you know. I mean, it's difficult. She was sitting quite a long way back at key points in the race, which was unusual, but because she is so strong normally, there's nothing to say that she wasn't sort of sandbagging a little bit and had plenty to throw at people.
I think one of the problems, or perhaps the beauty of the course in general, regardless of whether it was under 23s, women or men, was that so many people thought that they could win, because, you know, it was open to the punchers, it was open even to a certain extent to the climbers, it was open to the sprinters. In all of the races, I think there were 40, 50 people who thought that if the group was together at the bottom of that final climb, there was a scenario in which they could win. And I think that applied to all of the races, and that is why we didn't see more happening earlier on in all of the races.
Yeah, true. I mean, the women's race, there wasn't really a lot of attempts to try and break it up from being a sprint. And then when they did get the chance in the final 5 kilometres, because it's, what was it, just under 4.8 kilometres from the top of the last hill to the finish. They did have it in the bag, and Lizzie Armitstead afterwards, I mean, you could see from her face she was absolutely, you know, she said she was gutted that it didn't work out, and she said she'd have done it all differently had she the opportunity to do the race again, which obviously when you don't win, everyone would say that, wouldn't they? But it was very hard for her and all of them to, once they'd settled back into that larger group, to then regroup and try and open up their sprint again. And Armitstead did do, You know, she did do the sensible thing once they'd been swallowed up. She tried to get on Giorgia Bronzini's wheel, which was the smart wheel to follow. I'm not terribly sure many people would have thought Ferran Prevot would be the one to watch in that finishing sprint. I thought Bronzini had it in the bag, but she...
I was tipped by Freeboss in the podcast last week.
Well, there you go. But, you know, Italian, so, you know, there's a slight bias there. Daniel's always biased towards the Italians a bit.
Well, he likes his French as well. I have to say, Ferran Prevot, it does cap a great year for French cycling, doesn't it? I mean, and another young talent coming through.
Yeah, it does. And I thought they rode really well in the men's race yesterday. They didn't have a finisher. They didn't have anyone who was going to, well, as it turned out, who didn't finish in a sprint. So Buhani was really out of contention, but he rode extremely well. I think he finished 11th. I thought Warren Barguil was absolutely outstanding. He was everywhere. Maybe because he's two different people. Maybe because he also rides under a nom de plume, Romain Bardet. Maybe that's why he seemed to be so ubiquitous yesterday. But he was very good. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in the French press today about how this year has really seen them make the definitive leap back to the kind of forefront of the world stage. They've been sort of nibbling around the edges for a long time, but Galopin yesterday was really the equal of some of the top punchers in the world, Valverde's, the Gilbert. So, no, the future looks pretty good for them.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So one of the headlines, I suppose, from the week at the World Championships was the changing of the guard. Ferran Prevot and Kwiatkowski both being part of a sort of new generation. This is something that Lionel was in full spate about earlier on, before we started recording the podcast, ranting and raving he was about this media obsession with youth and the changing of the guard. Down with the youth.
Well, no, not down with the youth.
Answer to that.
Not down with the youth. That's not what I meant. And let's just make the point clear that the World Championships, I bagged both races there, really, and they weren't great spectacles from a sporting point of view, but they were two very good, very worthy winners, and two fine sets of shoulders for the rainbow jerseys to rest on next year. And that is great. It is great to see when talented riders come to the fore. But I think we always fall into this trap of talking about some as if there's some kind of collective generation of people. There's always young riders coming through. That's how life works. Young people become older, and as they get older, they get better at things, particularly in sport, and then they break through. And they generally break through at around about the age 23, 24.
But we always, I mean, it's equally human nature to get excited by young, talented riders. But seeing that you can, imagine that you can sort of see the future a little bit.
But it's always true. It's always true. It's yes. always true to say that young riders are coming through, because they are. Otherwise, cycling would stop.
Just because something's inevitable doesn't mean that it's not fun, Lionel, or enjoyable.
I mean, there is. I think one valid point to make is that for a few years now, we've seen a trend whereby 22, 23, 24-year-olds are competitive very early in their careers, which wasn't the case during the EPO years, because... most people's hypothesis about that is there was a period of grooming of 2-3 years when riders perhaps weren't on the heavy duty drugs, and then they graduated to that later. So it was the 27, 28, 29 year olds who were really dominating things. Another point that I've heard made in the last few years is that juniors and under 23 riders now train better than ever and have more know-how than they certainly did once. They're certainly in countries like France, they're very used to training with SRM meters or power meters in general, and really know what they're doing. So there's no real period of apprenticeship when they turn pros. They're pretty much fully fledged pros when they are still riding as amateurs.
I suppose the hierarchy of teams as well, there are perhaps more opportunities for younger riders to come through. You've spoken a bit in this year in the podcast, Daniel, about the talent pool being much bigger and wider as well. And, you know, we're seeing riders from countries. Kwiatkowski is Poland's first ever world champion, isn't he? And he's riding there with a full nine-man team in support. So, there are lots of factors and circumstances that could go into... there just being a greater spread of talent. But you did mention a real representative of the older guard, I suppose, Fabian Cancellara, and he was heavily fancied for the World Road Race. He missed the time trial to focus on the road race. Maybe not his last chance, but he didn't really look like winning, did he?
No, apparently he seemed very tense yesterday in the morning. I think he knew it was probably, well, it was a perfect course for him. You know, we all had kind of envisaged a scenario where he would attack hard with 5 or 6 kilometres to go and just bomb down that descent and hold off a group, and it didn't happen.
I mean, he could have done what Kwiatkowski did maybe a couple of years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, I think everyone was just so focused on that final climb and they'd really sort of shut their eyes to any other possibility in terms of going for the win. And just going back to the young rider thing, it is kind of cyclical as well, how I think, you know, when a particular nation or a particular team is weak, there's kind of a hidden blessing in that. You know, again, with the French, what happened was because they'd had almost a power vacuum for many, many years, a lot of young riders were given opportunities. And, you know, that happens in kind of underdeveloped countries as well. Perhaps Poland 5-10 years ago wasn't that developed in cycling terms, or they didn't have a lot of riders, so, you know, more riders were given opportunities, etc. And you look at the Italians and the Belgians, for instance, you know, those riders, the young riders in those countries, had their path blocked for many years by, well, in Italy's case, certainly guys who were exposed as drugs cheats, and consequently now coming behind them, they've got a lot of guys who have not really been thrust into positions of responsibility. Same in Spain. You know, there's really nothing coming up in Spain. There's no one there who's served an apprenticeship of 3 or 4 years, got used to leading races, because the guys who've always led teams there are Valverde, Rodriguez, Contador.
There's also the phenomenon of senior mates do well, like Romain Bardet, Warren Barguil, if they are not indeed the same person.
Siamese twins.
Thibaut Pinot. But, you know, if you see your countrymen, your peers...
That happened in Britain as well, didn't it?
It happened in Britain. They talked about this a lot in the track programme, that if you saw Chris Hoy winning Olympic gold medals and you were training with him every day and you could measure yourself against him every day, you could see what kind of gap needed to be closed. You could start to imagine that it was possible. The other, the mysterious sort of other, the opposition, didn't perhaps seem like different species as perhaps they had in the past. Let's look ahead to the Tour of Lombardy, but first just a little bit more about Kwiatkowski. I think he's riding Lombardy, and so that'll be his first outing in the rainbow jersey. Probably got quite a good shout in Lombardy as well, and with the form he's got, having proven that he's not going like a dog, Daniel. But on Kwiatkowski, I mentioned that we'd spoken to him earlier. I went and interviewed him in February as well in Mallorca at the Quickstep training camp in one of these big deserted out-of-season hotels in Mallorca. And he's a very impressive, very mature young guy who, still only 24, he started an academy in his hometown of Torn, which is modelled on a sports school that he attended himself. It's a cycling academy. There are 120 kids there from age 8 upwards. He's put his own money into that. He's got a sponsor for it. It's something that he's very, very passionate about, helping to develop a young generation of Polish talent. But I thought that was a very unusual thing for a 24-year-old at the start of his career to do. He also said, obviously, 2013 was quite a big breakthrough season for him. His performance at the Tour de France had increased his profile quite a lot in Poland, led to quite a few invitations to chat shows and public appearances and so on in the off-season. He turned all of them down, he said, in order to focus on the following season. I spoke to some people in Quickstep around that time, Omega Pharma Quickstep, who said that he had worked incredibly hard over the winter. I remember then he won his first race, I think, in Mallorca. So he started the season off riding well. And again, Daniel, you were mentioning the doping that has perhaps held back younger riders in the past. We're seeing also now riders winning from the start to the end of the season. We're seeing a greater level of consistency, which I think you can equate to a more, inverted commas, natural type of performance. It's natural that good guys should be good in February, October, all the year through. You'll have minor peaks in form, but you won't see somebody going absolutely terrible in February, March, April, and then flying in July. Is that fair to say?
I would say so. I mean, we don't really see the kind of meteorites who would soar and then just, you know, dissolve into nothing. The kind of, dare I say, Giorgio Furlans. people like that. It's quite rare, isn't it, these days?
I think so. I think that level of consistency is fairly reassuring, because a good rider should be a good rider. He should be able to win in February and September. A good rider is a good rider.
Interesting about Kwiatkowski in the press conference yesterday, said that he feels that he's more of a classics rider than a Grand Tour rider, and will continue to be You know, presumably, well, I think we know that it's going to be the hillier classics. It's going to be the Ardennes. It's going to be, I think he's got a great chance of winning Lombardy on Sunday.
He loves the Ardennes classics, certainly. And he was on the podium at Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Well, the podium at Liège-Bastogne-Liège was the same, different order, but the same as in the World Road Race on Sunday. So for all my critical sort of negativity about the course and the way the race went...
And life in general.
Well, no, I mean, you know, that's a little bit harsh. I mean, you know, I have to spend 3 weeks in a car with you, Richard, at the Tour de France. I mean, that's in, takes me 3 months to get over that. Yeah, I think a good race is always when you see three of the strongest riders come to the fore right at the end, just because it didn't happen in the most dynamic and exciting way, perhaps, you know, certainly the lead up to it. But just one thing, who would have thought that we'd get here and talk about the World Championship road race and not mention Peter Sagan? I mean, we haven't, he didn't factor at all. I mean, as you said, you know, that looked like the sort of course that would have suited him perfectly, and he's been nowhere.
Yeah, I don't really know. Well, I don't think anyone really knows what's happened with Sagan in the second half of the season. I mean, and he seems to get into a bit of a negative spiral at the Tour de France when he failed to win a stage, having come close several times, and then reported for duty at the Vuelta, seemingly overweight. He'd lost that weight at Ponferrada. He certainly looked pretty lean, but didn't figure at all yesterday. And the fact that... he didn't have much help from his team. I mean, he had the Veilitz brothers riding for Slovakia. It wasn't really an excuse, because there wasn't an awful lot of pressure on his team to do anything. He didn't have any problems, mechanical problems or physical problems that I know of, and was just didn't really figure. It was quite a strange, anonymous performance from Sagan.
It's a problem that he signed a £4.5 million contract or whatever it is, €4 million.
Who knows, but... I think he'll feel the heat from Mr. Tinkov if he, you know, doesn't come up with some big wins early in the season next year, don't you?
That could be an interesting relationship to watch. We remember a couple of years ago how Tinkov reacted to Contador's below-par performances. You can just imagine having signed Sagan on the sort of money he signed him on. They're best friends at the moment, aren't they? BFF, but that might not last for long if he's not in winning form at the start of next season. Lombardy, what's going to happen there, Daniel?
Well, it's a different course this year. Finishes back, finishing in Bergamo again after a few years away from Bergamo. And there's what became quite an iconic finish, sort of the 90s and the early part of the last decade, over the old town in Bergamo, a bit of a cobbled section. So should be good. I expect Kwiatkowski to be very good. I thought Dan Martin would be very, very good, but he didn't fare too well yesterday. He was never really in contention.
Did he crash?
Okay. Badly?
I don't think so, but I think enough to destroy his chances there.
And, you know, otherwise I think it'll be the usual suspects. Joaquin Rodriguez usually goes well in Lombardy. Any tips from you guys? I've got something to say about another Italian race in a minute, Milan San Remo Rich, but on Lombardy, anything to add?
Well, I think it would just be the same people that were up there in the World Championships. It kind of always is. It's a strange one, really. The World Championship being so late in the year, it feels like the end of the season, really. And Lombardy doesn't quite have the same sort of wow factor that it used to have. Certainly for me, I don't know whether that's a bit unfair. I preferred it perhaps when it was very much the last race, and there'd been a bit of a gap between the World Championships and Il Lombardia, as we now have to call it. It's been excitingly rebranded. So the Giro di Lombardia, as it used to be, nicknamed the Race of the Falling Leaves, but it's kind of not quite autumnal. It's more late summer now, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, a few things have happened. One, it used to be the last and decisive leg of the World Cup, as we used to know it. Also, I think this is something that's been said about Lombardy throughout its history, that the course has probably been changed too much, and it really lacks iconic climbs, an iconic finish. I mean, the Ghisallo is obviously the iconic climb of Lombardy, but this year it comes very, very early in the race, won't really have much impact on who wins the race. And the finish itself, I think they've gone back to the best finish that we've seen in recent years anyway, the finish in Bergamo, but for many years it's been fairly anonymous, chopped and changed. So and you know, they're also it's not the bookend to the season that it once was. I mean, we've got the Tour of Beijing that comes after Lombardy this year. That's going next year. So Lombardy, I suppose, will return to that kind of symbolic position at the end of the calendar, more or less. Anyway, there might be one or two races afterwards.
Sticking with Italy then, Daniel, and looking ahead at Milan-San Remo, what's the news?
Yeah, just there's going to be a minor change to the route next year. There's going to be a new finish line outside the old railway station. The distance from the bottom of the Poggio to the finish is going to be pretty much identical, so not an awful lot is going to change on that front. And the Pompeiana climb, which was supposed to get introduced last year, but didn't because of landslides and various logistical problems, and that is not going to be on the route. So it's going to be more or less the route we saw this year. Limagne, the climb that comes after the Turchino fairly early in the race, that is also not going to be on the route, I'm led to believe. I spoke to Mark Cavendish about this the other day, and he was very, very excited about the news that Limagne might not be on the route next year, and also that the Pompeiana might not. We had thought that this year, 2014, might have been Cavendish's last opportunity, because we expected the Pompeiana to be introduced this year. It's not going to be. So he's excited about that. He's finished his season. He's not going to race again. He's going to race a lot on the track this winter, and he's very keen to hit the ground running next year, not least because it's the last year of his contract. I think he feels, and his management feel, that Quickstep will want to start negotiating fairly soon in the season. They're keen to delay it slightly because they think that Cavendish can have a really good spring and really bump up his value again. And if, you know, I'm not sure how many options there are going to be in terms of teams next year, suitable teams that really meet all his requirements. I know that Team Sky have been sniffing around again, but I don't think that's an avenue that he wants to explore again.
That's Rod Ellingworth, isn't it? Has said a few times that he fancies bringing Cavendish back to Team Sky.
They've also approached him, but I don't think that he's something that he's particularly interested in. Oleg Tinkov has also made very, very tentative inquiries. Again, I don't think that is a viable option with Sagan there, Contador there. There's not going to be a lot of room at the big races, at the Grand Tours. So I think Omega Pharma, especially with Boone and Starr kind of on the wane and him sort of moving towards a sort of slow exit, Cavendish feels that he's got more and more sway in that team, that he can really be the focal point, certainly as far as sprints are concerned. And so it's a good fit in that respect. So I think he wants to stay, but obviously the price has to be right.
Although he's got the world champion on his team now as well, of course, and Kwiatkowski's profile will rise an awful lot, the pressure expectation on him. So this week's exclusive news, right at the end of the podcast, what track, you reckon he's going to do some track racing this winter? What is he going to do, do you know?
Not entirely sure, but I think there'll be some... I think he spoke about this in the press, or this was... This was revealed in the press. I think he's going to do some, maybe a World Cup, some 6 days, and maybe also Revolution in the UK.
Bradley Wiggins did mention at the Tour of Britain that Cavendish had been badgering him to ride the Madison at the, presumably at the World Cup. He wasn't up for that. That's not going to happen, but that was interesting, we thought. Anyway, shall we wrap it up there, fellows, and return next week? Thank you very much for listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore, and I was with Daniel Freeb.
Thank you.
And Lionel Burney.
Thank you, Richard.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboom, visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.